Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode in the second series of The Political Football from These Football Times. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit unquestioned devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase their power by using football as a political tool. The political football looks at a few examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces, and also questions whether at times football has kicked back against these forces and provided a means to counter them. This is the political football, and today we'll be looking at club rivalry in Northern Ireland. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this series with my good friend Stu Horsfield. How you doing, Stu?
Hi, Gary. Yeah, good, thank you. As always, very excited, looking forward to it. Another expert, another topic, another country, all good stuff.
Absolutely, buddy. So who's our guest today, mate?
Today, our guest is Ben Roberts. Ben's a Charlton Athletic fan, but probably more pertinently to, given the focus today, he was born to a Northern Irish father, who in turn was born to Northern Irish parents, and so on back through the generations. In 2017, released a book entitled Gunshots and Goalposts. What a great title. Written as an accessible history of the game in that part of the world. So obviously, therefore, not only an avid interest in football in Northern Ireland, but also a wealth of knowledge and understanding of the complicated football picture there. So, like I said, really excited. Let's get on with it and talk about club rivalry in Northern Ireland with Ben. How are you doing, Ben?
All right, I'm good, thanks. How are you, lads?
Fantastic, great to have you on board, matey. Been looking forward to this. It's one of these sort of situations where I guess if you don't live in Northern Ireland or have first-hand knowledge of the situation there, it may be difficult for people to understand the complexities of the society and how that affects football.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. It's one of those where, as you say, unless you're sort of intimately acquainted with it, a lot of the complexities can wash over you. And, you know, even one or two of them would have washed over me sort of 4 or 5 years ago, perhaps.
So just to start off, Ben, do you want to give us a little bit of the political context to give us the listeners an idea of the situation?
Sure. So when football was coming about in Ireland, which was a little later than in Scotland and England, the sort of situation was such that there was some football played in the sort of private schools in Dublin, but it was in Belfast where it was played much more widely and was much more of a working man's game. And obviously, just as everything else did around that time, so we're talking 1880s here, late 1880s, just as everything else was at that time, it was a fairly sort of a fairly sectarian nature. So you had clubs that were located in certain areas that would have been traditionally Protestant areas, and then you had clubs in other parts of the city that either had more mixed fan bases or tended to have a more Catholic or Irish nationalist fan base. And kind of leading, we were sort of at that point 25 years away from sort of Irish, sort of nascent Irish independence movements, and kind of 30 years away from Ireland eventually gaining some form of independence from the United Kingdom. So so football wasn't in any way exempt from those tensions, and you know, in some ways exacerbated them.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the club rivalry in Belfast then, if you can, Ben. In the first series, we had a guest talking to us about Belfast Celtic, and they went out of existence a while ago. And there was talk about the club returning. So if they do return, because particularly they were a Catholic club, as I understand it, would that shake up the football map in Belfast?
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen, actually, in the last couple of weeks, the club that had been after taking the name Belfast Celtic has been given permission to do so. So that was kind of in the news about 6 months ago, and they didn't get the permission as quickly as they'd hoped for the start of the season that we're in now. But they will, Sport and Leisure will be able to do so for next year. I think it's an interesting one. Obviously, it's not the same club, although it will be going by more or less the same name. But Belfast Celtic did have a very strong place in the heart of West Belfast, and it had come about sort of within 5 years. Linfield, which was very much the hardline Protestant club in Belfast, along with Glentoran. Linfield and Belfast Celtic, within 5 years of each other, had come into existence, and their grounds at the time were very close to one another, just across the Bog Meadows in that area of Belfast. So the games between the two teams were like, you know, if you look at attendances in the Irish League now, you know, even Linfield and Glentoran, the two biggest clubs, will be lucky to get a couple of thousand fans. But these games were pulling in north of 20,000 on a regular basis. But there were certain incidences of fixtures, particularly between Linfield and Belfast Celtic, where that tension that existed outside of football kind of spilled into the football. So there was a match in 1912 where there was some gunfire. You got to remember, obviously, in 1912 was famous for the Titanic, which was built in Belfast. But it was also a lot of other stuff going on in Belfast in that year, not least of which the Ulster Covenant was signed by quite a lot of what we'd call unionists, people that wanted to maintain links with Britain and maintain sort of the rule of the British Crown in Ireland, and particularly, I think, as they were starting to see, it, at least if it couldn't be the whole of Ireland, then at least in the bit of Ireland that they were in. So actually, my great grandfather was one of the signatories of the Ulster Covenant. So within that same month, just a few weeks before, there was a match between Linfield and Belfast Celtic, as I say, there was some gunfire. You know, a certain amount of hospital admissions and just a real kind of explosion of the tension that was on the streets into the stadium.
Okay, that's great. Esther?
I love this so much. Ben, I'm really interested. You talked about, obviously, if I take you back about 10 minutes, I'm really sorry. And you talked about, so you started off around the 1880s with football in Northern Ireland. That sort of time period, it's right on my street in terms of football history. Mm. And you talk about, obviously, the sectarian differences there. Was it like it was here, very much, I suppose, slightly earlier in England, I suppose, where it was an amateur game and very much from the public schools and the middle class sport, where it eventually became a working class sport, like we say, through the Industrial Revolution and, you know, coming into the cities and so on? Was it the same there in Northern Ireland at that time as well?
It was to an extent. Dublin was where it was much more of the public schools, and it was much more of the gentleman's game. Belfast was a lot different because it was so close to Scotland. So you had a lot of Scots who were maybe in their early 30s. They played a bit for some of the clubs in Scotland, Queen's Park and so on. They were perhaps not quite of the standard to play there anymore. And they would come over sort of in the 1890s and try and teach some of these guys in Ulster how to play football properly. Because it really, the first game, I mean, there's obviously, as all of these things are, where there's not a huge amount of documentary evidence, they're always disputed, but you think it's thought that the first game was probably around 1878. So it was a cricket club, Cliftonville, and a guy from the cricket club had gone on his honeymoon to Scotland, and he'd watched a game of football while he was in Scotland, and he enjoyed it so much that he'd invited one of the teams over to play, and they brought another team from Scotland and played a game on the in the Ulster cricket ground. So Cliftonville came about. So Cliftonville's Ireland's oldest team, and they were an amateur team. So most of these teams, after they've been around for 10 years or so, they became basically semi-professional teams. They paid their players. They weren't paying them full-time, so the players had other jobs. But Cliftonville was a fully amateur team until, I think, either 1970 or 1971.
Wow.
So they didn't pay their players at all. And then they, by about 90, whichever one of those years it was, they'd finished bottom of the Irish League. There was no relegation until the 90s, but Cliftonville had finished bottom the Irish League for about 11 seasons in a row, so I think they thought we better start paying these lads. We might get some ones that can actually play.
I love the idea of the guy going to Scotland on honeymoon and then watching a football match. I'm not sure there's many people would get away with going on honeymoon and then watching a football match.
Yeah, you've got to imagine his new wife must have been a bit sort of miffed, although I went on honeymoon last year and I managed to watch Brazil v El Salvador and DC United v New York Red Bulls. So
you're just as bad then.
Yeah, well, I'm still 6 months, so I'm still married.
Yeah, probably.
We were staying in DC, so Brazil, you know, Brazil play those Chevrolet matches where they just Chevrolet send them sort of anywhere in the world that they want to, and so they were playing at the Washington Redskins stadium. So I'm not going to pass up an opportunity to watch Brazil.
That's
fair play, mate. Fair play. Just a quick question about a couple of the clubs in Northern Ireland. I don't know if I'm representative of most football fans who are sort of more akin to English football. In Scotland, you know, we know more about the clubs, but the clubs in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, and I guess some of the South Border as well, we don't know so much about, but they've got some really great names. A couple of them are like Crusaders and a Distillery. I mean, yeah. The idea of a club called Distillery it conjures up all sorts of images.
Let you into a bit of a secret here. Distillery is basically my team, in as much as my dad. So when my dad was about 10, his dad used to take him to watch Distillery. The Distillery at that time were playing in West Belfast, but they had a sort of playing base that was broadly mixed. They had a lot of Scottish players, so they were able to kind of mix up Protestants and Catholics, partly because it was the 50s and 60s and things hadn't got quite as bad as they would get, and partly because if it was an English Catholic or a Scottish Catholic or whatever, there was just a lot less going on, basically, because, you know, they didn't have that inbuilt tension. So my dad's dad was a vicar, basically. I'm not entirely sure why he took him to Distillery, because it involved a journey up the Falls Road, but I suspect it might have been because he didn't want to go to Linfield or Glentoran and see blokes from his church and have to sort of do some work on a Saturday, basically. So, Distillery are sort of a little bit of a place in my heart there.
Okay. With the, I guess, and this is following on from what we had discussion we had in the first series when we were talking about Belfast Celtic with other guests. A lot of the clubs, their support is done geographically and I guess socially and religiously and politically from certain areas within the city. And Paul, the other guest, was telling us particularly about Belfast Celtic and Linfield. But are other clubs, such as like Distillery, for example, are they very much of the same ilk?
So Distillery actually moved. So they were in West Belfast, but they had quite a mixed fan base, although not a large one, it has to be said. But they had, like, Martin O'Neill used to play for Distillery. Derek Dugan played for Distillery. So some names that would be known in English football. But in 72, I think the ground was bombed out. So they had to move out. It's basically where the ground is a sort of a motorway now, or well, not a motorway, but a main road. So Distillery moved. They shared a ground with another club in Belfast for a few years, and then they moved a little way south, just 5 or 6 miles, but to Lisburn, which is actually where my dad was born. So they moved closer to one of their fans, basically. And that got them out of Belfast. So, you know, it moved them to a slightly different fan base where there was already a lot of clubs in Belfast. But really, there wasn't a lot of opportunities for, you know, finding a new home in Belfast in the 70s or 80s. It wasn't somewhere that you particularly wanted to set up shop. So Glentoran and the East Belfast club, so they're another long established club and the sort of second most well supported club in Northern Ireland after Linfield. And you've got Linfield, who draw a lot of their fan base from the Shankill Road. When we're talking about the Shankill Road, perhaps just for people who might not be so familiar, that is one big road, but it's the roads that come off it. So it's a whole district, basically. So Linfield are by far and away.
Yeah, okay.
In Northern Ireland and the most commercially viable. And then Cliftonville, just quickly say, were a very poorly supported club, as I say, an amateur club until 70s, and then in around that time the sort of the area on the Cliftonville Road, the bit of the Cliftonville Road where Solitude, their ground, is the sort of demographic makeup of that area changed a lot from being a kind of lower class Protestant area, because people were being displaced from other bits of the city, Catholics having to move out of bits of the city that they were in, sort of enclaves that they'd had in East Belfast, them to move out. So they moved up towards that part of North Belfast and ended up becoming a much more Catholic and nationalist club, and would be seen as the sort of foremost representative of that section of Belfast society today.
Sure. I mean, it's fantastic. As Stu said earlier, you know, we've done, I don't know how many of these now, 10, 15 of these podcasts already, and it's great just to sort of sit here and listen to the knowledge that, you know, all our guests have, and we learn so much. And I said, you know, about the exotic names of clubs, and I think, you know, you mentioned Solitude. I mean, I'm not sure there's a better written name for a football stadium I've ever heard in my life than Solitude. I mean, you know, you almost think you've got to stand there on your own beyond the goals, didn't you, really? But Stu.
It conjures up, doesn't it? It's almost like you say, the names and the it's not almost a magical sense, but it's almost an otherworldly sense. I mean, when you think about, obviously, you know, Ben talked about the, you know, the Scottish influence that came over, and obviously, you know, the English influence was there, and yet it seems, certainly from listening to Ben talking, it seems like the football and the name seem to come from, you know, another world. It could have been halfway across the world, purely from the, you know, the imagination of the names and the images that it conjures up. But I mean, what I'm really interested in, Ben, and to be fair, this might come up a bit later on, but unfortunately my brain just works too quickly for my mouth. when we sort of look at Merseyside and Manchester, you know, football there, and how, you know, allegiances can cut straight through families. Was that, I I suppose with the sectarian aspect to all of this, was that ever a potential issue, or was it, you know, as families, you were in it, you know, there was no allegiance to another club, or was that still allowed and was that still okay?
Yeah, I'm sure it happened. You know, there will be once this goes out, there'll be somebody that, you know, writes in and says, oh, actually, you know, my great grandfather did this. It, you know, it probably did happen, but it was extremely rare.
Right. Okay.
What it tended to be was, if you were Protestant and you lived in Belfast, you probably supported Glentoran or Linfield, but you would have had a mixture of within families of which Protestant team you supported. So my dad's mum, all her family were Glentoran. My dad's dad, took my dad to distillery, but most of his family were Linfield. George Best, you know, some of his family were Linfield, a lot of them were Glentoran. Derek Dugan, similar, you know, he had some of his family, sort of one uncle supported Linfield, one supported Glentoran. But there wasn't a great deal of religious mixing at all, and that just became more so once the trouble started, because it was literally almost impossible to go from one bit of the city to another bit of the city. So, you know, without going mob-handed or with a police escort. So Cliftonville weren't allowed to play Linfield at home, i.e. at Cliftonville's ground, Solitude, for nearly 30 years. So it always had to be Cliftonville's home match always had to be played somewhere else, invariably at Linfield. Because it was the supposed... I mean, look, I'm going to get in trouble with this from someone. There's obviously lots of different reasons that you could put on it, but the RUC said that Windsor Park, as it was then, Linfield's home ground, Northern Ireland's home ground, was the easiest ground to police. So that's where most of the games were. Now, obviously, you were putting the games at Linfield's ground, and Linfield was seen as the big establishment club, and oh, of course it would be at home, you know, or you see guys, you know, big Linfield fans or whatever. Yeah, there's several ways of looking at that.
It's funny, sorry Gary, it's funny, I mean, it's something that I've never really thought about. So I suppose, you know, in those early days, away fans, you know, did away fans go? Was it too dangerous? Was it too risky? Or was it something that was accessible, and then, like you say, when the trouble started, it became less accessible and now more accessible again? Is it, you know, what sort of a format has that away fans following taken in Northern Ireland football?
It used to be massive, like, because Northern Ireland's small. Like, yeah, there's no way of getting around it. It's small. So it was easy to go to away games. You know, you only had 8, 10, 12 clubs, depending on what year it was, in the top flight. But, you know, it's not going to be more than a couple of hours away, although the train links in Northern Ireland are absolutely atrocious and have only got worse over time. But Belfast Celtic used to take tens of thousands of people, along to away matches, special trains on in the 1890s, early 1900s.
Wow.
To football matches, you know, West Belfast was sort of, it was always a bit, you know, these old newspaper reports always a bit exaggerated, but, you know, you paint these visions of almost deserted streets in West Belfast. And then when Cliftonville became a much more Catholic and nationalist club in the 70s, particularly by the late 70s, they had an ultras section, basically called the Red Army. So the Red Army would make it a badge of honour to go on the train to these sort of far flung to them, but, you know, these sort of obscure parts of Northern Ireland where one man and his dog lived, you know, the sort of the more dyed-in-the-wool Protestant it was, the better, you know, the more honour, really. And there's a book, Henry MacDonald used to be the Ireland editor for The Guardian, wrote, which sort of touched on some of this, and they'd get off trains in these sort of small, very small Protestant towns, the tiny train stations, get off and sort of scrawl up the provost or, you know, some kind of paramilitary thing on the wall of this sort of, you know, Protestant town that was 98%, you know, unionists, and then quickly rush back onto the train before it it set off to wherever they were going. As you got clubs like Portadown and a few others outside of Belfast who might have seen themselves as they were almost jealous of Linfield, of its reputation as being the most Protestant club, because they'd say, well, you know, you're in Belfast, but, you know, we've put up with X, Y, and Z out here, and, you know, our town's kind of much, it's more Protestant than you, you know, it's a more Protestant than thou kind of thing. So Portadown was certainly one of those places, and that's where, I don't know if you remember, about 20 years ago, so when the peace process was just really kicking into life, and around the time of the Good Friday Agreement, but around marching season, Portadown is the area near where Drumcree is, where some of the most contentious marching routes were, and, you know, they're really a bit, I mean, you get it in Scotland to an extent as well, probably less so now, but you have towns and villages that are almost all Protestant or almost all Catholic.
Yeah, it's really interesting what you say about the clubs and how sort of different they are with their support and such. Like last time we were on, we were talking about Brazil and how different players in the national team had different political affiliations, and I guess that's probably massively magnified in Northern Ireland as well, because players coming from different teams in Northern Ireland, and I guess some from England and from Scotland as well, but when the national team meets up, there must be the issues around not only with the players but also with the fans that go and watch Northern Ireland play as well.
Yeah, so, I mean, you don't want to overstate these things and be too reductionist, but basically, you only go and watch Northern Ireland if you're Protestant or if you're sort of a very keen football fan that isn't a Protestant, that just wants to watch some football. That wasn't always the case. So, you know, you had Pat Jennings playing for Northern Ireland from a nationalist background, and he talks of, you know, when he was a kid going to watch Northern Ireland, and that wasn't seen as sort of wrong from his own community or from the Protestant community. It was just, well, it's nearby, let's go, you know, what's the big deal? But by the time you get to the 80s, where Jennings is still playing, but there's a whole lot of stuff going down, and if you're a Catholic in Northern Ireland, you're really starting to think, I don't feel comfortable here. You know, this has taken a turn. And by 93, you've got the game between Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. So a World Cup 94 qualifier, and Northern Ireland can't qualify. It's the last group game. Republic of Ireland need a point to make sure that they get there. And it's in Belfast. It's at Windsor Park. And it's just like this sort of seething atmosphere, loads of sectarian chanting, so the kind of stuff that you know you'd still get at Rangers, but you would have really heard at Rangers around that time as well. So, you know, songs the Billy Boys, songs about being up to our knees in Fenian blood, this kind of really provocative, really divisive, really sectarian stuff. So it was not a welcoming place. It's a cliche that often comes up. We say it was a cold house for, you know, X, Y, and Z community, sort of, yeah. Irish, Northern Irish cliche. But it was a really unwelcoming place by then.
Sounds like it.
And by the late 90s, even sort of well-to-do unionists, even, you know, just the average football fan wasn't going there, even if they're a Protestant. So there was a friendly against France in 99, maybe the year after France had won World Cup, and there was like 4,000 people there or something, because it was just like seen as, well, you know, to go there was just tantamount to saying, you know, I'm a bigot, basically. I mean, I'm not saying everybody there was, but that was the, you know, people weren't walking around in Northern Ireland shirts unless it was to make a point.
Sure. Stu?
Yeah, like I say, I mean, it triggers so much stuff. I suppose I'm just going to bring it quite contemporary now. With regards to sectarian chanting, how is that accommodated in football stadiums in these days, Ben? Is it, you know, is it seen as, what am I saying here, as offensive and discouraged? Is it encouraged? Is it just a part of the game in Northern Ireland and it's just accepted? Or how, you know, how is that sort of, how is that taken now in the modern game?
I mean, first of all, to say that it doesn't happen as much as it did 20, 25 years ago.
Right.
But it does happen. Obviously, in Scotland, there's certain laws around it, which don't exist in Northern Ireland. So it's not something that's strictly punishable by, you know, banning orders or, you know, potential prison time or fines or anything like that. It's not something that's encouraged at all by the clubs. And not saying it was encouraged before necessarily, but there was certainly a more of a policy from certain clubs of trying to look the other way. But the clubs now would all try and discourage that. You know, they realise that they're living in a sort of global society where, you know, everyone can see that the world's looking at them if something happens. So you had Linfield playing Glasgow Celtic a couple of years ago, would it have been, or last year even, in one of the very early qualifying rounds of the Champions League, and just the clubs, Linfield having to kind of really lay down the law, because they knew, well, this is going to be a big match, and you know,
yeah,
turned out really badly for us from a PR point of view.
Yeah. Can I sort of take you away from the clubs a bit and look at it from a different perspective? So, with regards to the IFA, for the Irish Football Association, for example, or the police force or politicians, how do they view these conflicts between the clubs, and how do they, what's the word, manage them, shall we say?
So, the IFA, choose my words carefully here, but so until 2003, there had been a few new clubs admitted. So in 96 they introduced relegation, and there was, you know, they kind of opened up the divisions a little bit more, the actual football divisions, not the sectarian ones. But there was a couple of clubs, Lurgan Celtic Donegal Celtic and Lurgan Boys, who were essentially nationalist clubs who had wanted to join and had kept getting knocked back. And then because there was lots of sort of equality bodies set up with the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process, they went to one of the equalities bodies and said, look, we keep getting knocked back here, and we just want to join, and, you know, we think it's not fair, and it might be because of X, Y, and Z. So in 2003, those two clubs were admitted. So there is a perception, and there had been a perception, especially up until the mid-2000s, that the IFA either explicitly or implicitly, you know, had a bias towards the Protestant clubs within it, which obviously they would strenuously have denied. But it was around 2004-05 where so Neil Lennon had basically been drummed out because of a little bit of there'd been a bit of booing from the crowd in the years leading up to that, and you know, it was like, well, it was a fraction of the crowd, but nevertheless it was too big a fraction of the crowd, because really, you know, any fraction of it is too much. And then he'd got a death threat that had purported to come from one of the, I can't remember precisely which one it is, I think it was the LVF, but let's leave that ambiguous because I can't remember which one it was. Basically saying if he played that night, then he would be a dead man, essentially. So Lennon had retired from Northern Ireland, playing for Northern Ireland, and it was kind of, there'd been some efforts to try and change the crowd and sort of change the way that that football was being dealt with, but it really helped to kick, it was a kick up the backside, basically, and it was needed, because, you know, there was not many people going along to football, either to watch Northern Ireland or to the clubs by this point, and something needed to happen. You know, it's unfortunate that it had to come about how it did. And around this time, Northern Ireland were absolutely hopeless as well. They went a couple of years basically without scoring. There became this little black humour in the crowd that almost forged this new kind of identity. And so you'd have songs like "We're Not Brazil, We're Northern Ireland." It was really cheesy. It was a bit naff, but it wasn't sectarian. So, you know, it was a lot better.
Yep, Stu.
Yeah, it's funny. When we talk about this, I always find myself being drawn towards whatever the national governing body, how they sit, certainly when it's such a sectarian divide like we have it here in Northern Ireland. I know you're not going to know the answer to this, Ben, but I suppose I'm interested in your point of view. But in terms of the sort of the Northern Ireland FA, in your opinion, which camp are they a neutral body, which I suppose, you know, they should be, by all rights they should be, but are they favoured towards one side? You know, is the, well, you know, is the sort of the FA board made up of, you know, do they try and make it up so it's very much an equal representation, or is it heavily sectarian?
I mean, it's not openly sectarian, but so 5 years ago, I think Cliftonville and Glentoran played each other in the Northern Irish Cup final. And they said, right, because the ant, obviously, as it is at Wembley before the FA Cup final in England, there's the national anthem. But obviously, you know, I don't sing the national anthem. I couldn't give a rat's, really. But obviously, it's a much bigger deal in Northern Ireland. And because Cliftonville were playing, they said, right, it's not going to happen this time. No anthem. Okay, and then last season, Cliftonville in the final again, and no such decision this time. So the anthem happens. So the Cliftonville players all bow their heads, and you think the situations that the IFA put players in that they don't have to, and that sometimes they don't, but sometimes they do. And really, you'd think that the wisest thing to do in a contested society like Northern Ireland is to just remove some of the symbols of that contestation and say, look, we know this is a unique situation. This isn't Wembley. This isn't even Hampden Park. This is Windsor Park. This is Northern Ireland. There's going to be one of these clubs that this is, you know, they don't see the Queen as their head of state, and you know, they've got valid reasons for that. Let's not put them through it. But last season they did, and then as I say, the Cliftonville players sort of bowed their heads, but it put them in an uncomfortable position, because you know, to have not done that, and to have you know, well, not they wouldn't have sung it, but you know, to have given it some sort of credence, certainly a number of years ago, that would have put a player from a nationalist area in an uncomfortable position in his own community. So
it's a classic example of politics in infecting football. Just you mentioned about players there, it's quite interesting because obviously people of any vintage really can remember some of the great players that came from Northern Ireland. George Best, you mentioned, Derek Dugan, Sammy McElroy, Martin O'Neill, Gerry Armstrong. Were any of these players particularly embroiled in the rivalries, or was there any player who was particularly tied with one club that that sort of he became like an icon for them?
Most of them didn't stick around long enough in Northern Ireland to get too closely associated with one club. Obviously, Martin O'Neill played for Distillery for a little bit. George Best was seen by Glenn Torren as being too light, basically.
Oops.
It was a very... well, you got to think that, you know, the league as it was in the late 50s, early 60s, early 60s as it would have been when Best was kind of 14, he would have got completely kicked up in the air. For that type of league, he probably was too slight. You know, he needed to grow a little bit. There aren't many players that stuck around long enough really to become too closely associated with clubs back home.
I was particularly thinking about Warren Feeney.
Yes, well, Warren Feeney. He had a long line of relatives or grandfather, cousin, possibly even father, who'd played for Linfield as well. He does have that very long-standing association with Linfield. He went back to manage them after he'd finished as a player, and actually had his own sort of misgivings about the IFA, because Linfield used to own Windsor Park and sort of lease it to the IFA for international games and cup finals and so on. And the ownership situation sort of changed somewhat. And Feeney just felt like Linfield had lost their spiritual home, basically. He really did have those links with a club, despite having come over to play in England. But they were really strong familial links, you know, going back generations.
Okay. Steve?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I was just, as you were talking then, I was just sort of casting my mind back to sort of some of Northern Ireland's, you know, sort of players. And I think for me, the 82 World Cup, for a lot of different reasons, is one of my most favourite footballing memories. And certainly that Northern Ireland side, you know, of 82 is, you know, is a side that I can remember quite well. And when you look at the playing personnel that went through it, and I suppose there's almost... like it's a little bit like South America, isn't it, where, you know, at club level they have decent players, but the minute anybody seems to go above a certain standard, they're sort of hoiked away to England, or, you know, in South America's case, across to Europe. And so there's never really that chance to really establish club size, which means the league never seems to get established, because the better players are constantly on the move. The minute any sort of discernible talent is demonstrated, you know, it's across the Irish Sea, and, you know, and to the English clubs as well, which I suppose is, I mean, you know, do you think it's had players have stayed, you know, do you think maybe club football in Northern Ireland might be, you know, stronger than it is now?
Probably not, simply because it's a population of well under 2 million, so it could feasibly support probably two or three sort of established clubs of the kind of size that we would imagine being viable on a professional basis. So unless those two or three clubs were to say join a Scottish league, or a sort of combined Scottish and, I don't know, Welsh and Republic of Ireland league, you know, something like that, where it just had two kind of beacons and the other clubs kind of faded into the background, in that way, but there just isn't the population base and the infrastructure there, unfortunately, to have ever made that, particularly after Belfast Celtic had left the scene. You know, that they, along with Linfield, were one of the major draws. You know, they were what made the game in Northern Ireland known outside of Northern Ireland, so primarily just in the UK and in the Republic. And without that, there isn't that sort of star power, that star quality. So you can't imagine, really, there's just, you know, you need money to pay those players to stay there. Linfield tried with having some players full time as recently as sort of in the 2000s up to about 2011, I think. It was probably when their last professional full professional finished. They had maybe half a dozen players, but you know, you have to be going some in Europe, you know, getting to the last qualifying rounds before you get into the qualifying rounds proper, you know, to have, you know, you can imagine $100,000 to clubs there is a huge deal. Yeah. You know, you could get a couple of players on contracts for that, but you know, it's slim pickings. It's looking for the scraps. In the Republic, Dundalk were a good example of that a few years ago, of getting into one of the groups in the UEFA League, I think. And actually, people thought, well, Dundalk are just going to win this league forever now. And it turns out that wasn't true. But it did put them in a place where they could sort of revolutionise what they were doing and how they travelled and how they trained and so on.
Does football struggle against some of the more traditional Irish sports as well?
It would, to a certain extent, obviously. Until the 70s, there was if you wanted to play Gaelic games, i.e. if you were a nationalist or a Catholic or both, then you had a choice for sure. But so Martin O'Neill's an example of that, where he played both, but then it got to a point where he had to choose football because the GAA authorities, and this was sort of at the tail end of their real power, which was sort of comparable to the Catholic Church, really. But if he was seen to be at a football stadium, not even just playing football, but you know, if he was just seen to be at a football stadium, then that was grounds for either a sort of long-term suspension from playing Gaelic football, or just, right, you're never gonna play at this club again.
Wow.
So for nationalist players like O'Neill, like Jennings, a host of others, usually when they got to their sort of mid-teens, they had to say, right, I'm choosing football. And you know, I still enjoy Gaelic football, but, you know, that's not viable. Now, there's no such formal kind of bans as there were then. And Gaelic football is obviously a proudly amateur sport, so the financial incentives are a bit different because they might come through sponsorships. But a lot of that was gambling in Gaelic football. A lot of that was gambling sponsorships, which they've done away with now. So,
right,
yeah, interesting stuff. I mean, we get one of the things we sort of covered a lot of is where politics has affected football, and one of the elements of the discussion we have on here is how sometimes football can impact back, and you know, sometimes sport is seen as a unifying force in troubled communities. So is there any elements of that with regards to the sort of identity of the club, the rivalries therein?
In the sense that they would have a positive impact, or
So basically, what I'm saying is that politics has affected football massively it's Northern Ireland's society, let alone football. But and the divide between religions as well as political outlooks. But sometimes football can be a unifying force. And I guess we spoke about the Northern Ireland international team where Protestants and Catholics play. But is there any evidence to suggest that football has given more hope to a less diverse, shall we say, more than, I'm not going to say more unified, but perhaps a less diverse, less antagonistic situation?
I think attendances at Northern Irish League games have certainly been, certainly up until maybe a year ago, I'm not sure about figures for the last year, they might have taken a bit of a knock, I'm not sure, but they were rising quite rapidly, so people were starting to come back to football. After a long absence, and you know, dads were feeling happy to bring their kids again because you know it wasn't as bad as it was sort of 15, 20, 25 years ago. You know, clubs in '98 when Cliftonville played Linfield at home again for the first time, there was a sort of big. There was only like, I think it was like 300 Linfield fans that went. I think it was capped at maybe 500 Linfield fans, but even less than that actually, you know, put their names forward for going, and all the route was kind of blocked off along the way. The IUC just wanted it to, you know, pass as peacefully as possible. But when they got there, the Linfield fan, the Cliftonville fans were holding up banners basically saying in Irish, a thousand welcomes Linfield, and then you know they'd have a sort of translation of the banner in English. So there was an effort among those fans to consciously say, you know, 100,000 welcomes, you know, this is a new era, this is post Good Friday, this is football's kind of Good Friday moment. Cliftonville fans do tend to be the ones that are most associated with the sort of social conscience. It probably irks the fans of other clubs that they've got that reputation, but it does tend to be that Cliftonville would have, as a lot of non-league clubs, you know, I go sometimes go and watch Whitehawk or Eastbourne Town, because they're both reasonably local to me, and they have reputations of, you know, collecting for food banks and that.
This might be an impossible question for you to answer, but how do you see the future playing out? So, you know, will the club rivalries always be defined by religious and political considerations, do you think?
Probably as long as religious and political considerations exist, then you know, they'll exist in football as well, because we can't get away from the fact that football, or you know, whichever sport, but football as a sort of mass participation sport is going to reflect the society that it's in. It might reflect a certain, you know, more of a certain part of that society, you know, more of a working class aspect of that society than, say, a middle class one that rugby might do. But it is going to reflect the society it comes from, and it might sometimes feed back into that society. But as long as you've got to see, I guess, that like anywhere, part or one of the motivators for supporting a certain club, not always the only one, is it close to me? Can I get to it quickly? And if you live in East Belfast, then Glentoran's close to you. But if you live in East Belfast, you're almost certainly going to be a Protestant. So, you know, these things go hand in hand. It might be that those things become less important, let's say, but as long as you've got areas that are divided in that way, which you had in Liverpool and Manchester 120, 130 years ago, and you'd still have in Glasgow now, but you know, you wouldn't say that any part of Liverpool or any part of Manchester, well, you maybe in Liverpool, but you barely say that any parts of either of those cities were Catholic or Protestant, you'd just say, you know, it's such and such road or such and such close.
Sure, Steve.
Yeah, I suppose one last thought from me, Ben. I mean, obviously, you know, right at the beginning, we talked about, you know, you talked about your dad and, you know, and grandparents and great grandparents and association. I mean, I suppose in terms of how they've seen the game develop, you know, through longer than yourself. How do they see sort of Northern Ireland football?
So my gran, we think one of her uncles, so one of her relatives anyway, who is a little bit older than her, so her maiden name is quite rare. There's only sort of 200 or 300 families with that name in the whole world. And much to her sort of chagrin, when we looked it up, it's largely a Catholic name. She's very much not a Catholic, but basically one of her relatives, and it can't be a distant relative because there aren't really any distant relatives, had played football for a time in Northern Ireland, and some of that time had been for Belfast Celtic. One of the things is that players did, I mean, much more so now, like you have Catholic players playing for Linfield and so on. But it was for players, there was a certain sort of, there was a bit of a barrier, but it was sometimes crossed, particularly before the Second World War. You know, after that, Linfield largely only had Protestant players unless they were foreign Catholic players. The Second World War, because after the Second World War, there was a... Ireland had had dominion status, the Republic of Ireland had had dominion status till 1948. So it was in the Commonwealth. It was a bit like Canada, basically. And then in 1948, they sort of threw off the last chain and went, you know, for a full kind of fully autonomous republic. So there was a sort of uptick in tension in Northern Irish society. You know, I've talked to my gran about this in the late 40s, and that did, I mean, that was the thing that did it for Belfast Celtic, because there was this tension, and that, in 48, that really did spill over onto the pitch, sort of 36 years after it had done, around the time of the Titanic. And there was lots of reasons why Belfast Celtic went out. Some of them were financial, but when there's one reason, you think, well, there's ways we can get around this. But when there's three or four, you start to think, is it worth getting around these? My gran, we'll talk about that sometimes, and you know, she'll I was on Sky News about 6 months ago, around the time that Belfast Celtic, that Sport and Leisure were thinking about taking the Belfast Celtic name, and I said to my gran, oh, you know, gonna be on TV and this is why. And she said, oh, you know, it's daft. I remember, you know, when Belfast Celtic were around, and you know, they're just doing it to stir up tension, and you know, they should leave it in the past. And to be honest, that's more or less what I went on TV and said.
Maybe they should have put your grandma.
Yeah, it's time is always an enemy of ours on the political football, and Stu and I are getting engrossed listening to you expert guys talk about fascinating subjects such as this. And we always have a same closing question, but before I go to the closing question, I want to ask you a little bit about your... tell us a little bit about the book that you wrote, Ben.
So I wrote a book, Gunshots and Goalposts, The Story of Northern Irish Football. So it's sort of a fairly fast-paced look through from the late 1800s at Irish society, at Northern Irish society, in a footballing context, sort of with football as its lens, but seeing football in that wider setting, and then right up to more or less the present day, kind of culminating in Northern Ireland reaching Euro 2016. So that's Gunshots and Goalposts.
I assume it's available on Amazon and such sites as that?
It's available on Amazon. It's available on waterstones.com. If you're in Northern Ireland, it's available in Waterstones in store. If you're in Glasgow, it's in the Saucy Horse Street store. It's in Easons in Ireland. So it's available in lots of places.
Well, if the knowledge you were expressed in the book is anything more... Like you've said today, I mean, it must be almost compulsory reading for anybody interested in football in Northern Ireland. So, you know, keep a lookout for that, guys.
I should just quickly say, if you'll indulge me for another 20 seconds, that another book coming out at the end of July called Bottled: English Football's Boozy Story on Pitch Publishing, which is about booze and English football, basically.
When does that come out, Ben?
End of July.
Right, okay. You know what I'm thinking, don't you, Gary?
Yeah, I do. Actually, do you know what you're thinking? We have another series that we do, Ben, called The Centre Circle, which we interview authors to talk about the books that they're any books upcoming or recently published. So,
I've been well up for that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll.
This is going to be my. I mean, I sold. I assume you're going to cut this bit out. So I just say I've sold a reasonable amount of this book, but I published it myself. But this next one's going to be on Pitch Publishing, who are, you know, a proper specialist sports publisher. Yeah. So I think this one might actually sell a few.
Brilliant.
It sounds like you went down the same road I went on. I self-published my first book and then went through an official publisher afterwards. But you know, I'm... The first book is the one you love, so you know, it's like your firstborn. But
yeah, it was the learning curve that I wanted. Really, I think I would have crumbled if I'd had a publisher for the first one. So the pressure would have been too much. So
we'll talk about that a little later then. But before we go, we always have the same question that we ask our guests at the end of the Political Football, and. I'd be interested in your thoughts, particularly on such a sensitive subject that we've been discussing tonight. So the key question is this. Can football exist in a political vacuum, or does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? In short, is the political football inevitable?
Yes, I think it is. There's no way of... nothing exists in a vacuum. Least of all stuff that, you know, draws lots of people into sort of a passionate exchange of views, or, you know, kind of engenders that competitiveness and that sort of territoriality that comes, you know, even from, you know, different bits of the same town in the southeast of England. You know, I go and watch Eastbourne Town and they occasionally play Eastbourne United, and they're 2 miles apart, but there's even a slight political undercurrent going on between people that, you know, ostensibly look the same, you know, live next door to each other. So I think there's ways of channeling that more positively, and I think you can kind of reduce the negative impact of that, and sometimes perhaps even bend that into a positive impact. But those tend to be things that have to be done very consciously and very deliberately, and would happen over time.
Fantastic, Stu. Any final thoughts?
I always have the same final thought. Like I say, I love some. These evenings are fantastic. It's such a learning curve, and I always make notes about things that I need to go and read up on and look at. You know, as soon as we've sort of finished, and I've got about half a page already of stuff that I need to go and look at just from what Ben's chatted about tonight. You know, as always, it's an absolute pleasure to listen. It really is.
Yeah. We've had some great guests on the Political Football, you know, and Ben, you're right up there with them, and your knowledge of Northern Ireland football and the clubs and the identity and the different fans and the pressures and societal issues that go around football in Northern Ireland has been immense. And I've also massively learned, as we do every week on the Political Football, Stu has mentioned earlier. So let's say a massive thank you to you, Ben, for coming on the pods.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No problem. So thank you for listening. This has been the Political Football, looking at club rivalry in Northern Ireland. And we hope you'll catch us next time on the next episode of the Political Football, when we're looking at another area in the world where football and politics are intrinsically mixed. Thank you. Good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.